This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Jim Adenzi and Tim Batten from The Real Ale Shop.
Hey.
Morning, Chris.
Morning. We spoke to you guys last week and we were sort of talking about the difference between wine drinkers and beer drinkers and trying to understand a little bit about that. This week we're going to go down the hops path fully and we're just going to talk a bit about mainly the brewing process and how the different beers fall out from that brewing process. Before we start, can I just sort of give you a 2-minute monologue about my thinking of brewing, and then Jenna, because you are the master brewer, the expert here, you can correct all my mistakes. How does that sound?
Let's go for it.
Okay, yeah. So beer is basically barley. You malt it, and malting it changes the insoluble starches into a sugar that the yeast can gobble up, basically. And you malt it by just germinating, getting it warm and wet, germinating the barley. The enzymes are released. Then you dry it out. If you just dry it out a little bit, you'll get a pale malt, and that might be used in a lager. But if you cook the heck out of it, you can burn it almost, and that will change the sugars. They'll caramelize maybe. They'll maybe go a bit darker. And if you wanted a crystal malt or a chocolate malt, which are dark malts, that will make dark-colored beer. So the difference in color of your beer is just basically how much you cook it up after you've got the barley germinating to release those enzymes. Then you take your malted barley, you grind it up, you stick it into some sort of pot with a load of water, you boil the stink out of it to get the sugars out. You might chuck in some hops at that point, and if you add hops at that point, you'll get a bit of bitterness coming into it from the hops. You then remove all that muck, and just you've got this nice clean liquid that's got some sugar in it and a little bit of barley flavor and a little bit of hoppy flavor, maybe if you're going down that route. You ferment it. Just like you would with wine, and then sometimes you might even chuck in some more hops at the later stage, which, because that's, you're not boiling that stuff, the aromatic components from those hops tends to stay in the liquid, and that you get all those aromatic flavors from your beer. You then filter it out again, and you stick it in a keg and flog it to some bugger. To some person.
Nice summary, Chris.
And that's the way I look at beer, and it's pretty basic. Oh, and also, the more barley you put in, the more sugar you're going to get out, so your higher alcohol level in your grain. And that's my basic brew. So that falls out your IPAs because you've got your sugar and your hopping levels, your dark beers. It doesn't include any of those weird Belgium flavored beers that you get and all sorts of lactic beers. But what's wrong with that? Or is there something I've missed?
You had some great detail there on what's happening to the barley before we're using it as the malt in the brew house. And then we don't boil the hell out of it. The reason for that is it's very important that we maintain all those wonderful enzymes that we've been very carefully keeping in place during the malting process. And those enzymes are going to break down. So then we rejoin your story, which was correct. You're using those enzymes to break down those sugars into the size of sugars that yeasts like to chomp up. And then harnessing the beautiful natural process of yeast, which is to eat sugar and then produce alcohol. What a fantastic cell they are. And yes, you're right, taking those hops and putting them in. What we'll tend to do is we'll separate what we call the wort, which is the sweet liquid that's produced in the brew house. We'll separate the wort from the malt grains before actually adding the hops in the copper or the whirlpool. And so once you've got that slightly clarified wort, then you'll take that into the copper where you will boil it. And it's very important to boil the wort at that stage. There's many actions that are occurring there. First of all, you're sterilizing the wort. Mm-hmm. And so from that point on, cleanliness, clean, clean, clean. Cleanliness is so important in the breweries. And if you talk to any brewer, they will tell you how much time, probably 95% of their time they spend cleaning, because past that point of boiling that wort, any other infection in that brew will give you some off flavors that you don't want. And so you're trying to look after that, the flavors that you carefully gathered together in your recipe. And you're also isomerizing the hops, which basically means taking the alpha acids from the hops themselves during the boiling process. That's where you're getting that bitterness. And so once you've got that bitterness in the liquid, then you can, and you've sterilized and you've, you can cool that liquid down to, that works down to about, well, different temperatures dependent on what your recipe is, say 18, 20 degrees. And much, you don't want to have that temperature too low or too high because the yeast don't like it. Too low, the yeast will go to sleep and they won't produce all that wonderful alcohol for you. Too high, and the yeast get a bit stressed out and they'll produce some very strange off flavors for you.
Can you control the flavors being produced by the yeast and the fermentation temperature? So for an example, in wine, if you ferment at a higher temperature, some of the flavors actually boil off and you lose the floral type flavors. You get the development of esters.
You don't want to stress the yeast out too much. So it's very dependent on the yeast strain that you're using and what you're actually trying to achieve. You might be producing a sour, and so you'll be using some lactobacillus. And so you need to be considerate of the organism that you're looking after. And so that's really where the brewer's knowledge comes in, and understanding what they're doing to sort of look after that organism. But yes, if you can change the flavor profiles depending on the temperatures that you're fermenting at, but also the strain of yeast that you're using. And this is something that many brewers share the yeast and will use the same type of yeast. You'll see the same type of yeast used across many different breweries. Some breweries will have the same yeast that they've used for decades and won't use a different yeast strain, because that yeast gives them the flavors that they are happy to impart to their beer.
I've always thought it was weird that, you know, because you hear people get talking about their yeast that they've kept for hundreds of years or whatever, you know, and they're using the same yeast strain, but yeast just changes, yeah, and multiplies and breeds, and over time that yeast will not be the same yeast it was 50 years ago or even 20 years ago.
Well, you have to look after, you have to make sure it doesn't become infected with other yeast strains, so make sure that you're not getting any other wild yeast in there. Some of the larger breweries will actually send away a sample of their yeast in a yeast bank, and every so often will call on that to then grow a fresh batch of their own yeast strain, so that they're ensured that they've got that continuous supply of the particular strain that they like to use.
One of the things that some people do, I don't know if you probably know them, Curious Brew, which is Chapel Down, the wine company, they do some, yeah, weird stuff with their wine yeasts. And is wine yeast and beer yeast, they're both a yeast strain called Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It's the same yeast that we use in bread making, beer making, wine making.
Yeah.
Wine has lots of different versions of Saccharomyces cerevisiae that people use to get different flavors in the wines and different characteristics.
That's right.
Is there much crossover between wine, beer, and bread yeasts?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're all, you can still use those different varieties. Some of the yeasts are better at performing at higher alcohols, you see. And so the wine yeasts tend to be the strains that are better at performing at those higher alcohols. A lot of the beer yeasts, the lager yeasts, and the ale yeasts prefer to exist, live, work in those beers that are between sort of 4 to 6%. And once you're wanting to explore going to those higher strength fermentations, then you might want to look at, you know, yeah, using a different strain of yeast that would be happier in that environment.
A mate of mine used to live in Kuwait, and it's illegal to purchase and have alcohol in Kuwait, but it's perfectly legal to buy grape juice, and it's perfectly legal to buy bread yeast. And the shops in Kuwait sell, right, bread yeast and grape juice right beside each other. The wine he produced right. was pretty dodgy, I must admit. If there was much options, I wouldn't have gone for it, but win in Rome, so to speak. But bread yeasts, it's all fine as far as you're aware? It's just not...
I wouldn't use the bread yeast that I use to make my sourdough or my my spelt loaf in my brew at home. I would seek out the brewing strains from a reputable supplier. But yeah, I haven't actually tried it, to tell you the truth. It's all, as you say, it's all the same. It all comes from the same yeast in the end. So maybe that's an experiment I need to do, Chris.
Yeah. And Curious Brew, what do they do? They do something weird with the wine yeast, don't they? Or is it the lees from the fermentation process, the dead yeast?
I'm not completely familiar with their process, actually, in that product. I know that they use champagne yeast probably in the secondary fermentation, and I think maybe that gives a slight different change of the bubble that you might get in the CO2. But
people get obsessed with that in the shops, like with champagne yeast. Oh, what's that champagne? But it doesn't actually, as far as I'm aware, affect the flavour at all. It's just the carbonation. Done right at the end, but yeah, because I dare do that.
It's a point of interest, though. You know, it's interesting, and it's another aspect that brewers look at. To...
Mm-hmm. A lot of the flavors you get in beer are from hops, and hops are a flower. And the Americans went a bit crazy trademarking every hops you could possibly come up with a wee while ago, and they produced all sorts of citrus flavors and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the sort of fruity flavors you get in beers come from the hops. But you also get a lot of malty, biscuity flavors in some of the beers. Where does that flavor come from, and how do you enhance that in the beer?
From the malt itself. So
But I always find sort of darker beers or mid-range brown ales and that, they tend to be more malty than lighter beers, perhaps. I don't know. Am I just...
I think it's also how you match the hops together. So we were talking last week about some of the styles that are having a resurgence, or some of the English bitters and the milds, where if you're matching some of those darker malts, the chocolate malts, the crystal malts, Munich malts, with some of our British hops, Rambling Cross or Goldings, then the two will complement each other and really bring out a very gentle grassy aroma on the hops, but also allow those malty flavors to really come forward. So yeah, I think it depends on how you can match your hops together with your malts. What you're trying to do is create that perfect marriage, aren't you? You have that hop variety. You know, some brewers get really excited about using a single hop variety, and there's always new hops coming out. And there was one this summer, Talus. And so that was, you know, a lot of the brewers were very excited. They were talking about the pink grapefruit, the citrus rinds, but then dried roses, all sorts of different aromas that were new, that were coming from this new hop. And so we get a lot of excitement from perhaps exploring a single hop and creating a malt base and grist that will allow that hop to sing on its own. For a consumer to explore, you know, if they're interested in, and I think this is, you know, for wine drinkers as well, they might be interested in a particular region or a particular grape. Well, you can go down that road with beer as well when you look at the different varieties of hops. You can seek out specific hops or hops grown in specific regions, and they'll give you a different flavors. So,
Nelson Sauvin.
Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I actually haven't tried that, but I know that it's supposed to taste a little bit like a Sauvignon Blanc, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, big time. Just like gooseberry, kind of passion fruit, all that stuff. Yeah, it's from the same area, obviously, similar kind of flavour profile, delicious stuff. You should try it. It's probably my favourite hop.
Is it grown anywhere else outside of New Zealand, or is it?
I know it originates from New Zealand. I mean, I'm not an expert in hop growing.
If they do, they won't have the same name, but I don't think it does.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And what's the sort of trends? As I was saying, I think last week we talked about lactic beers as being a bit of a trend a couple of years ago. And you mentioned this Talus hop that's got these new flavours. Is there any other styles of beer or anything like that that's on trend at the moment? Because it seems to be quite a trendy, changing category.
I mean, low and no is a huge thing. We've already talked about that, the low alcohol beers. Kernel table beer, for example, it's certainly not new, but it remains probably our biggest seller in all the shops. And it's a 3% session IPA table beer, packed full of flavour. Cider's having a bit of a renaissance as well. You know, a lot of people getting into cider this year, especially kind of French ciders as well, seem to be very popular. You know, the slightly sweet kind of Normandy style.
We've had a lot of sours coming through. I mean, the quality of the sours and goes that's coming through has been phenomenal, hasn't it, Tim?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been going on for a few years now. I think, you know, kettle sours have kind of started people off, getting people kind of used to kind of slightly tart, very fruity sour beers. And now it's kind of evolved to slightly more challenging but more full-flavoured, in my opinion, beers being produced by the likes of Pastore Brewing in Cambridge, and a very kind of full-flavoured, stronger, kind of naturally sour beers. They're delicious. They're really kind of blazing forward.
Jenna, how do they make sour beer? Because I understand it's like a Brett yeast or something dodgy like that that's gone off and then they sweeten it up with fruit.
No, I mean, it's just souring bacteria, isn't it? Lactobacillus primarily. Brett sometimes is a factor, but that's certainly not, as far as I'm aware, a souring influence. That's more of like a funky kind of aftertaste in beers. It's slightly different to...
Can be more challenging, can't it? Yeah.
So it's the lactoacid bacteria that's making the beer sour, because that's weird, because in wine use... Malolactic fermentation reduces the acidity in wines, converting the malolactic to lactic acid. But that's the same, but it works in beers as well.
It's a slightly different process in beers, I think. With wine, as far as I'm aware, it's the conversion from the malic to the lactic, and the contrast of the two is softening, although the malic is still, you know, still an acid in itself. It's just it's less prominent than the malic, which is like the green apple kind of sensation you get.
That's right.
And it's not appropriate in certain wines. So I guess the acidity isn't as much of a factor in beers. I don't know. Primarily.
Yeah. Do you know much about sour beers, Jenna? Is that your thing?
It's not. I haven't been able to brew the beers myself. But I certainly enjoy drinking them now. It took me quite a while to train, having been drinking beer for a few decades now. It took me a while to train my palate to appreciate sour beer, because originally, when I first started doing tasting training in 1996, sour beer means it's an off beer. But that's not the case anymore. And actually, you know, there are some fantastic flavors that are being harnessed, and some amazing fruit mixes that I really enjoy.
That's interesting, though, isn't it? Because the thing about beer, well, wine's got acidity as a key backbone in most wines, whites and reds. But beer isn't a particularly acidic product, isn't it? Even when you're talking about sour beers.
Yeah, so it naturally is a pH normally of around 3.8 to 4.4, and the sour beers are heading down below that. So it's naturally acidic, and that's part of that happens during the brewing process. The pH is naturally reduced, so it gives the beer longevity. So that's why in the past beer was always seen as sometimes safer to drink than water, because it naturally protects itself from pathogens won't grow in beer because of the pH, the alcohol, and actually the hop compounds as well. The three of those together mean that actually pathogens can't survive in beer. So
yeah. You mentioned earlier, you talked about alpha acids, and I know there's alpha acids and beta acids in beer. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the alpha acids, isn't that what gives like the fruitiness and the floral kind of character from the hops? And
yes.
The other kind is the bitterness.
Well, the alpha acids are used during the isomerization in the kettle to create the bitterness. And some of those acids are within the hops as oils, and those are what you're wanting to make sure that you don't boil the hell out of in the brew house, because you want to capture those as the aroma within the product. So as you mentioned, you put them in as a late hop later on in the process, and you can extract those aromas and keep them within the beer so that as you're drinking it, you can enjoy that.
And the last question is, because you guys started out really originally as a sort of a camera sort of supporting house. And one of the things about Canberra is they're really into their bottle conditioned beers. You know, that is, if it's not bottle conditioned, it's almost not like beer for them. Cask ales and all that sort of carry on. But just on bottle conditioning, my understanding is just yeast. Sometimes they just add yeast to it, or sometimes it's the brewing yeast, whatever. But in wine, when you leave the wine in contact with the yeast for any period of time, either one of two things happens. Either you get a sort of an increased mouthfeel from the yeast. It can give a mouth texture. But sometimes the yeast breaks down. In the wine world, we see it with sparkling wines, where we call it autolysis. And it releases yeasty, bready, biscuity flavors into the wine. What's bottle conditioning beer really doing to the beer?
Well, you're getting that secondary fermentation in the bottle. So you're getting an extra bit of carbonation, you're fermenting some of the residual sugars, and we're not wanting to get that autolysis of the yeast, because that off flavor in beer isn't from the yeast itself, isn't one that's seen as a positive attribute. And so really with bottle conditioned beers, you'll find that yeast will settle on the bottom once it's done its job, and if you pour the bottle correctly, then you'll keep that yeast on the bottom, but you'll still enjoy the product of that secondary fermentation in the beer itself without having to drink a slug of yeast.
Is the yeast dodgy for you? Because my dad worked for a brewer for quite some time, and he used to think that the yeast strain, if you weren't used to it, could encourage you to go to the toilet a little bit more often. So the issue wasn't so much that a particular beer was dodgy in that respect. It's just that whatever beer you got used to that yeast strain, and it wasn't really a problem. And if you changed beers, he believed anyway that if you changed beers too often and drank the different yeasts, you could end up visiting the little boys' room a little bit more often. I don't know if he was...
No, unfortunately, I think that's an old wives' tale. It's really just about the cleanliness of the beer and the lines itself and how it's looked after in the pub, to tell you the truth. And, you know, what you might fancy eating afterwards. so it's...
Do you think it's more the curry that you have afterwards than the...
Yeah, maybe. Yes.
Nice. Okay, then. I think we'll wrap it up there, guys. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Nice to talk to you.